Finance, come to order. It's 1:51 p.m. on the 24th day of February 2014. We have members present, Vice Chair Newman, Representative Edgman, Representative Wilson, Stoltz, Representative Costello, and Representative Munoz. We have a quorum to do business. We will first take up House Bill 199. Oh, we'll just stand a brief at ease. No, I'm sorry. Get your coffee and your drink. Get your coffee and drink. Back to order. We have the bear quorum to do business. We did a minute ago. Two, three, four, five. We had it when I gaveled in. Who stepped out?
No,
oh, of course. What a dolt I am.
Yeah. That's the first time.
No, it's a repeat performance. Welcome, Representative Bryce. Thank you for bringing this public policy issue before us. We'll present the bill today and hear public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 36, which is in the southwest portion of the state. The bill before you really is what you see on the first page, in the sense that it's insertion in the state statute language that would basically not prohibit the Department of Public Safety from prohibiting village public safety officers who otherwise meet minimum standards and training from carrying firearms. And I'll sort of underscore the minimum standards and training portion for a moment, because we've heard a lot about that in previous committee testimony in terms of what exactly a VPSO would have to undergo in terms of training necessary to carry a firearm. And I'd like to assure the committee that that the training that a VPSO would undergo would essentially be identical to that of a municipal police officer, and would be similar to what a trooper would get. And in fact, in the training academy in Sitka, it would essentially be the same instructor who would be providing the training necessary for carrying of a firearm. But I should, Mr. Chairman, step back just for a second to sort of set the context a little bit for this bill and to talk about the VPSO program, a program which has been around since the late 70s, the early 80s. In fact, it's been around for long enough that it's really been hard to piece together sort of the historical elements of the bill. We've had to rely on some anecdotal information. My staff, for example, talked with former Commissioner Burton back in the 90s that he was commissioner, to get some insight into how events came into focus. But the goal of the program has always been to provide public safety officers in all of the rural communities. In the early 90s, the high water mark of 120 some odd, I think it was maybe 130 VPSOs were actually put into place. But the program through the years has seen its ups and downs, and has really faced its share of challenges in terms of recruitment, turnover, placement of VPSOs, keeping VPSOs at the job for enough time to rightfully learn how to do their job. And, you know, I'm here to say that the conditions in rural Alaska, I think, by and large, in a lot of communities, have been greatly improved over the years. You know, you can go out to any village and you see, in some respects, new runways, you see health clinics, you see in some communities new schools, water and sewer infrastructure has been provided to a lot of communities. But sadly, in the same breath, you know, a lot of our rural communities that VPSO serves, are also seeing changing social environments where domestic violence, where incidents of violent confrontations are on the rise. And all that came to a head on March 19th of 2013 in the community of Manicotok, unfortunately, when a VPSO, VPSO Madol, lost his life in the line of duty. So in, you know, really taking that whole incident to heart, and as, you know, almost as personally as the folks in Manicotic did, I introduced this bill to try to bring attention to the whole issue of properly arming VPSOs in environments where they often themselves are finding, you know, situations where it's them versus a perpetrator who's armed, many times with a high-powered rifle. So House Bill 199 was introduced last April in concert with regulations that the Department of Public Safety have been working on, as I understand, have been implementing to also allow VPSOs to be armed. But House Bill 199, Mr. Chairman, actually takes things a little further, even though it puts basically into law what already resides in regulation, in the sense that it brings the entire conversation forward in a committee environment where you get to hear people who, as best as we can encounter, strongly support this bill. And for those that might be a little bit hesitant about the ramifications of having a VPSO out in a community who's armed. But I strongly and vigorously argue that the time has come to consider this issue and hopefully to take action on the ability to arm VPSOs out in rural Alaska. And by putting it in a statute, it puts it into perpetuity. It does allow us to sort of look at all the elements, and it does. There's a fiscal element, of course, to properly training VPSOs who are out there in rural communities. Sometimes with direct access to an oversight trooper, many times because of weather or other events, they're on their own in terms of having to deal with, again, perpetrators who are armed as the VPSOs. They are not, and so. Mr. Chairman, I think I'm just going to stop there in terms of the introductory comments. I would assume there would be questions, and perhaps we could delve into the issue a little bit more deeply at that point.
Not wanting to interrupt the cadence of your presentation to your starting, our co-chair came in just as you began speaking, and we've also been joined by Representative Guerra just as you finished speaking. So, questions from the committee? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Edgemond. And I put my name on this, but since then, I've heard from five different state troopers with concerns with this bill about the training and what could happen and the possible taking of a life because of the functions that happen here. And I've been trying to consider the life of that VPSO also at the same time, trying to intervene into what could be some of the largest problems in the state, you know, out in rural Alaska, drug and alcohol abuse and those family-type programs, spouse abuses, they're the most deadly situations that an officer can get into. But what would, and I'm looking at the fiscal note a little bit, and it talked about the training that they would receive training for firearm safety, and that's basically what the fiscal note, it addresses the cost of that. But what about the psychological training that would have to go towards this program to make sure that there's a full understanding of some of the concerns that have been brought by state troopers, and I'm sure you've talked to those same troopers about that, so I'm sure you're familiar with the discussion. And also, if you could address what would happen or how would the state address penalties for VPSOs who use deadly force, I guess, with the use of a gun inappropriately.
Did you get all those questions?
I think I did, Mr. Chairman.
Take them in the order you wish.
Representative Newman. First, in terms of the training component, we've heard a lot about this in the previous committees. And I think the questioning of that element, by and large, has been pretty constructive because it's forced us to converse many times over with the department, and myself, my staff spent an hour on the phone with the actual trainer himself who does the training in the Sitka Academy. And the upshot of it all is that VPSOs will receive the absolutely identical training to that state troopers and municipal police officers receive, and it's training that's meets the Alaska Police Standards Council training, and it's training that also meets Alaska law enforcement training requirements. And as I say that, I think you'll probably hear the department as well when they come up to testify, talk about that this program is a pilot program. And as you read through the fiscal note, it's some $60,000 a year, and it envisions that about 20 or so VPSOs would be successfully recruited and then brought down into the training academy to go through all of the training requirements, again, that the municipal police officers and state troopers do. On the psychological evaluation aspect, again, identical to what troopers and police officers would get, complete with a doctor's physical examination, full criminal background checks, both statewide and national by FBI. And I would, I guess, close in terms of answering your question by describing the scenario about what happens if we didn't arm VPSOs. You know, that's the question that, along with the residents of Matagorda, that, you know, I'm left to ponder. And so with the proper training, the proper background checks, you know, the recognition that the department, you know, will be proceeding very carefully with this effort, I have, you know, the fullest of confidence that we're doing it right and we're doing it the way that we should be doing it. We're doing it the way that, you know, the other law enforcement officers get trained in terms of carrying firearms.
Follow-up.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Edgman, then it's my understanding of what you just said. It's the intent that they would receive the same psychological testing that an Alaska State Trooper would, if they would ever be allowed to handle a gun or not. And then also, what you didn't address is, I don't know what the penalties are for mishandling a use like that. Is that something that needs to be addressed, or is that already in statute?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, I don't know what the penalties would be, but I do know that VPSOs would undergo what's called the use of force continuum training, which essentially trains officers, those brandishing firearms, every technique possible in terms of the art of avoiding the use of deadly force, all the way to the situation where deadly force is unavoidable and a weapon would have to come into you know, the particular law enforcement situation. But I guess I'd quote former Department of Public Safety Walt Monaghan when he talked about the rare instances when a weapon really has been used over time in terms of law enforcement. And sure, we all know of instances, you know, some pretty high-profile instances, but by and large, you know, you don't use your weapon in terms of, you know, every aspect of law enforcement, which in the VPSO world runs the gamut from, you know, the smallest levels of public service all the way to having to confront somebody who does have a rifle, is barricading themselves in the house at the edge of a river in a village. So I don't think I answered your question, but I did want to try to give at least some information, and maybe that would be something that the department could answer more directly.
Yep. Captain Arlo, when he comes up, we'll ask, you can hone in on that, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Costello and then Guerra.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. I did want to mention when I visited a high school government class at Diamond High School, they actually brought this issue up. So I wanted to let you know that it's an issue that touches urban and rural, and the question is an important one. In the bill, I see that you'll transition so that some VPSOs will be armed on a sort of a transitional basis. And how will that decision be made as to which VPSOs will be carrying guns first?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, the VPSO program is a program that is administered sort of in a network of three moving parts, if you will. It's the Department of Public Safety, it's the regional Native Association or the Northwest Arctic Borough, and the community itself, that all work together to make this program successful and work together to recruit and to bring VPSOs into the program. And so that's the actual implementation of bringing in the 20 or so VPSOs would probably follow a similar process where all three of those entities get together and work to make sure that that the VPSO coming forward is a good candidate. I guess I would also add that the VPSO program is a program that involves the Native associations themselves, the VPSO coordinators meeting on a regular basis. I think they meet quarterly every year. This topic of arming VPSOs has been a very big topic of them as of late, and so I think it would be very much a cooperative process in terms of finding those 20 VPSOs, but it would be VPSOs that would have to, of course, in the end, pass all the requisite tests, training, and skill level requirements in order to be armed.
Thank you.
Representative Gera Osterman and then Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Angevin, I know you're probably frustrated, and that's in part what caused you to file this bill, is to sort of get us to move ahead with more rapid and effective use of VPSOs across Alaska. So I appreciate it, and I think that's important. I just want to see if there's committee support to make this as strong a bill as possible. I certainly want the bill to bolster the presence of VPSOs. I don't see the part of the bill. I see the part of the bill that says training will be required, firearms training, which I guess would include training for when you should use a firearm, when you shouldn't use a firearm, when you should use persuasion, and all the things you learn in the police academy and trooper academy. But I don't see the part of the bill that says that it's the trooper academy that would be used. I think I might have heard you say that, but I don't see that in the bill.
Where are VPSOs now trained, Representative Edgman?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Garrett, VPSOs are trained at the trooper training academy in Sitka. And that's, I think, been firmly established on the record. I think the department will certainly speak to that when they come to the table as well.
And through the chair. And is it at the full trooper training that VPSOs get, or is it a different training?
Well, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the training to become a trooper obviously is more extensive than the training to become a VPSO. But in terms of the firearm component, my understanding is that the training would be very similar between the two elements.
Okay. And just through the chair, so I understand. Thank you. So what kinds of things would troopers get trained in that we don't train VPSOs in, if you know, and if you don't know, that's okay?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could defer that question to the Department of Public Safety, I think you'd get a better answer.
Okay. And I obviously don't want a fiscal note to kill the bill. So.
Representative Osterman and then Munoz.
Mr. Chairman, I have the same question. I'll wait for VPSOs. I mean the trooper.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. It was on the similar questioning, but first of all, I want to, through the chair, thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. Responding to a tragedy in one of the communities that you represent, I think, is it's been very impressive watching you carry this bill and the public support that you've garnered and through this process. My question has to do with the difficulty that the department currently has in filling all of the positions that are currently budgeted for the VPSO program. And do you have any insight into whether or not this additional training might help the department in maintaining a fuller workforce?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, actually, I appreciate that question because, of course, I can't give you a ironclad answer in terms of what might happen in the efforts to recruit and retain VPSOs should they be armed. But it's certainly my sense as somebody who is from rural Alaska, who travels through villages on a regular basis, talked with a lot of VPSOs, that I think it would help. To what degree, I guess time will tell. but you know, the deterrent effect, the ability of VPSOs to feel safe. One of the sort of the emotional, the gut reactions I had and sort of led me to introducing this bill was to talk to the VPSO from the Chignik Lake area and how he described his wife not wanting him to leave home on a couple of occasions because she didn't know if he was going to come back. And, you know, VPSOs are armed with, they wear a protective vest. They've got a baton on them. They've got a taser gun. They've got handcuffs. They've got a form of pepper spray on them. But all that is nothing when you're facing somebody who's got a handgun or more on them, which is unfortunately becoming more and more the case out in a lot of these rural communities.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fine. Thank you.
Well, in some of our areas, they say don't take a knife to a gunfight, and we tell our VPSOs to take a flashlight to a gunfight. And that's. But, any other questions for Representative Edgman? I just have one. If I've heard there was some, there might be some interest from the some of the collective bargaining entities of entering this. Have you heard any of that? Or have they entered the debate in the previous iterations of the bill's journey?
Mr. Chairman, that's been the primary source of, I guess, outright opposition to the bill. And that opposition has ranged from questioning the sort of the thorough and comprehensive nature of the training to another committee hearing where psychological evaluations was the theme of the meeting. And then there was discussions about the fiscal note and whether it was adequate to actually get the job done. So the answer is yes, we have been hearing considerable opposition, I think, to the bill, and perhaps they might phrase it differently in the sense that it's not opposition to the bill, but it's opposition to their lack of the inadequacy of the training aspect of it all. I'm not sure, but to me it does sound like it is, frankly, just opposition to the whole notion, yep, top to bottom.
Well, I just sitting in this chair in an earlier time, there was opposition from some of those collective bargaining units and maybe even a rogue commissioner, a rogue deputy commissioner who was trying to hijack the VPSO expansion that's on a stage basis. I don't know whether it's because they don't collect dues from these VPSOs or whatever motivation, but it has been there in the past. And I hope if people have opposition, I hope they come out and express those in the committee process. And you know, they're certainly welcome just to count votes and try to do whatever they do. But I hope it's an open and honest debate on this because this is an important public policy issue.
Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up comment, you know, I think
that's not a gauntlet thrown out, but that's just a general request of people that might be listening outside of this room.
Well, I think, you know, in response to some of these points that have been brought forward, that they have been taken in a constructive light in the sense that, you know, we worked, have numerous meetings with the department, and we've heard from the department time and again their devotion to doing the training right, and they get us under the Police Standards Council, and we've talked to a lot of the nonprofits along the way. Some of the community members, I think if we had every community lined up here today, there would be some communities who say they didn't want their VPSOs armed, or that would some that would say they would take a lot of time considering this issue before they armed their VPSO. But in the end, in my view, it's all going to make this whole effort stronger.
No, I appreciate Representative Bryce at Representative Edgman. I'm sorry, Representative Edgman. I've known him since college. So Representative Edgman, you wanted this through a deliberative process that was introduced last year, but I think you very valuably used the time communicating with folks from throughout Alaska and explaining this. So I appreciate that. This is a big step forward. This and one I know you've taken very seriously. Looking forward to our main concern on here will be the fiscal issues, and that's our main responsibility in this committee. So we'll discuss that toward the end, but I think you've already highlighted some of them.
Representative Austin, did you have it?
No, Janelle.
Okay. I think both these folks are offline, so you can just stay where you're at if you wish and join in if you have comments. Captain Stephen Arlo from the Department of Public Safety calling in from Anchorage.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Captain Steve Arlo with the Alaska State Troopers.
Please give us your comments on this bill, and you've probably given
Mr. Chairman, I've kind of taken some notes through the last 20 minutes of some of the concerns, and if you'd like, I'll just go down and answer some of the questions that have been posed. That
were the two questions
for later.
We had, as you're making your testimony and your comments, there was the Representative Newman had the question on penalties, and you can ask him to clarify that if you wish when you get to that, and the issue of training were the two major ones that came up.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I took notes on that. The first question was, who would investigate cases where a VPSO used deadly force? And it traditionally in our agency, and quite frankly in any agency in Alaska, oftentimes the Department of Public Safety is asked to investigate small police departments in Alaska when they have a officer-involved shooting. Just like we do in our agency, we would bring in the Alaska Bureau of Investigations unit. They would come out and treat that like a crime scene. And go through a series of protocol that are laid out and would treat that just like any other investigation. And when the investigation is totally written up, a lot of times that investigation gets reviewed by the Office of Special Prosecutions. If we think there's any case where the officer used inappropriate force, the Office of Special Prosecutions would evaluate those things and make a determination if any kind of criminal charges would be necessary to be instituted against maybe an officer in a case like that. If all indications show training, skills, and situations were all justifiable, then the Office of Special Prosecutions would clear that officer of the use of deadly force, and then it would no longer be a crime scene but merely just a matter of a use of deadly force in an appropriate manner. So that's normally how cases like that go. I wouldn't think it would be any different if a VPSO were to have to use deadly force, regardless if they take a life or not, if they act, let's say they miss. It's still going to be investigated. I would almost certainly guarantee that the Department of Public Safety would be the first to take part in that investigation and do the same protocol as they would for any other law enforcement entity in Alaska. And once again, they're not our employees. The VPSOs aren't our employees. And we would defer that to Office of Special Prosecution and go through the same base scenario. Any questions regarding that topic that I could clarify?
Representative Newman, did you have any follow-up on that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that was a good clarification on those issues.
That's our goal here.
Secondly, Mr. Chairman, the question of selection of VPSOs for the pilot program, there was some discussion about that, and it's as Representative Edgman said that we recently met last week with all of the members of the VPSO program, nonprofits in the borough, and we have for over a year now been talking about this issue of a pilot program, and we would be selecting VPSOs in a particular regions, and we have a pretty good understanding of which ones we think potentially would be good candidates. That being said, that we wouldn't rely on that alone, so we would bring these pool of applicants. And the first step, we believe, would be the psychological evaluation like we do for the state troopers. We would hire a professional psychiatrist and go through the same testing that the state troopers do when they go through their psychological evaluation. Anybody who passes that section would get to go to the next. Anybody who doesn't pass that is not going to be considered to go to the training session in Sitka. Any questions on that particular response?
Representative Costello, then Osterman.
Thank you. So if you are to select a village that would have an armed VPSO and that person is already employed and doesn't pass the psych evaluation, would they then lose their job, or would you? How would that be handled?
Through the chair, ma'am, I think we wouldn't dismiss VPSOs for failing to be able to carry a firearm, and we've talked about this as well within the program. It would just be a case of this particular VPSO would not be able to be one that participates in this program. They could still be a VPSO, though.
So, like, if a truck driver couldn't pass a hazmat test, he wouldn't just be able to carry hazmat, but he wouldn't get fired as a truck driver. Mr. Arlo?
Mr. Chairman, that would probably be a pretty good analogy.
Boy, I search for him. Sometimes I hit it. Representative Osterman.
If there's no more questions on that,
There are questions. Representative Osterman and then Guerra.
The question was the same question, so I'm not sure that I totally understood the answer, because I don't understand what the psychological test is that would make the difference on carrying firearms versus just being a VPSO that can't carry a firearm. I can't quite compute what that means.
Mr. Chairman, I guess in regards to that, I myself have taken a psychological evaluation to become a state trooper, and I don't know what it means. It isn't necessarily something that we get to explain or get explained to us. It doesn't, if you pass a psychological evaluation, as what I've been told, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means that your particular personality and characteristics don't fit within the guidelines of what the profession in psychology believe is one that we would want to instill the responsibility of carrying a firearm. I think to get a more accurate understanding of the whole process, it would probably be more appropriate to bring in a psychologist to talk about that particular concept, but I don't think it precludes you from being a VPSO if you didn't pass the psychological evaluation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like it's some kind of a double standards that I don't quite understand, and I'm not sure how that would fare within the whole overall moral morale of the program if we had a double standard there. So that's just something we'll have to think about.
I don't think we're going to bring a psychologist in here. I think Representative Guerra.
Although I need one.
Thank you. I'm just curious. So, you know, the goal was to add 15 VPSOs every year for 10 years, and we're only net up 16 after 5 years or 18 after 5 years. And so I'm wondering why the training the screening component is going to be a pilot program if it's going to be done under standards we already have. I mean, why still move slowly when we're so far behind the goal of 15 a year?
Representative Edgman, would you care to cancel that? And you're the sponsor of the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Representative Guerra. The first point would be to emphasize that the difference between the actual number of VPSOs and the authorized VPSOs right now, and it's a number that can fluctuate from one day to the next, but the last that I checked, it was 29. In essence, there was 29 vacant positions. And I was looking at something else. So the second part of your comment escapes me at the moment.
Why a pilot program for screening as opposed to just screening?
Well, I think it really speaks to the very careful steps that the department and the non-for-profits are taking in putting this program into place. 20 VPSOs in the end could end up being a bigger target than what actually happens in terms of bringing VPSOs down to the training academy. You're looking for candidates who are going to be carefully screened and probably are going to be those candidates who've been VPSOs for some time, although that wouldn't preclude maybe a newer VPSO who would pass the psychological evaluation that the captain just discussed. But we're talking about bringing in a fundamental change to a program that is going to require some time, actually, to probably to put into place in terms of getting all the VPSOs or the majority of VPSOs. So I support starting out with a smaller number and then working towards a bigger number if it ever becomes a bigger number. We just don't know how this is going to play out.
On that part, I'm done.
Yeah. Okay. Back to Captain Arlo.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Osterman.
Captain Arlo, are you in charge of the VPSO program for the troopers?
Through the chair, yes, sir. I have been for the last 8 years, so I oversee the whole entire statewide program.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Munoz for...
For Captain Arlo.
For Captain Arlo.
For Captain Arlo. Good afternoon. This is Kathy Munoz, and I was wondering what the current pay for VPSOs is and what the department's intentions are to increase pay with additional training, or if that will, is that a consideration that, you're undertaking?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, currently the VPSOs make a very good salary. It's in some cases, it's more than some of our smaller police departments in the state make. So we don't plan to necessarily increase their salary because they're introducing a firearm into their job functions. So that to answer that question.
Okay. Onward with your testimony and presentation, Captain.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Regarding, if I could just talk briefly about the introduction of firearms in the VPSO program, there was some comments about why go through a pilot program. I think as Senator or Representative Edgman kind of touched on it, where we have a long-standing 40-year program without firearms. We want to be diligent to make sure that when we do introduce a VPSO into a community with that, that the community accepts it. We don't quite know yet how the community is going to accept this, so we want to start off small, evaluate that process, as well as the VPSO and how they are reacting to the use of a firearm in a rural environment. Because when you're in a rural environment, a lot of times you are the only law enforcement entity in there, and that is very out of the norm in a normal law enforcement society in Low 48. And even in urban Alaska, usually there is some form of backup. But in our rural troopers, a lot of times they're the only one. So it's very important to, even though you go through the evaluation process, a psychological evaluation, you're in a sterile environment in Sitka, and you're going through all these scenario-based, there's a point when we release troopers in the field training program for about 6 months. They are with another trooper. And so... they're still being evaluated for their judgment. We anticipate doing the same thing with this VPSO program, where we're going to match up a VPSO fresh out of the academy in a sterile environment now into a rural village. We're going to have a, a trooper with him or her to evaluate the real-life scenarios that occur and make sure that judgment is still intact in the real world. So that's why we're going to take very slow steps during this process. Any questions on that clarification?
Don't see any. Onward, Captain.
Mr. Chairman, reference the bill itself that talks about there's no indication about the Sitka Academy being the primary training location. Traditionally, as Representative Edgman said, that has been historically the place that we will train, and it will be the place where we will train with the firearm component. It will be the exact same training as any municipal police officer or state trooper receives. We're not going to bring a lesser quality training. It'll be identical. If you do not pass, you do not pass. We're not going to be negotiating on that matter. So I'm confident that anybody that passes that criteria would have obviously shown the skills necessary to go to the next level. with regards to, there's a lot of discussion about level of training, VPSO versus trooper. When we're comparing the duties of a state trooper and the duties of a VPSO, they are very different. The VPSO is a public safety servant. They do a lot of other things. In some areas, it has kind of morphed into primarily being a law enforcement component just because of the composition of the community. It's a high volume of crime and very isolated, and they become the first responders, and before the state troopers can get there, they're dealing with a lot of these things until we can get there. That doesn't mean that the training that they get in Sitka is invalid. It's just more extensive training goes into training a trooper than a VPSO. So some of the things that I have a list of the courses that are given to troopers versus VPSOs, and some of the things I could just highlight with regards to scenario-based. VPSOs get about 88 hours of scenario-based training right now. The state trooper or municipal officer gets about 280. The search and seizure component of training, it's 8 hours for a VPSO and double that for a trooper. For the law component, all the elements of learning about the law, it's about 36 hours for the VPSO and 58 hours for a trooper. Those are just some examples. They're both being trained on the different elements, just maybe not as extensively, because the VPSOs are going to primarily be dealing with the misdemeanor cases, and it's a lot different than the investigative skills that are going to be needed for the homicide and high-profile cases.
Captain,
so that's an example of some of those issues. If anybody have any questions on that?
Captain, I know a lot of these are remote areas, but the training at the Sitka Academy, is there a robust victims' rights training and awareness?
Through the chair, they will touch on those things, but again, those would be things that would be more enhanced, not only in the academy, but in the field training program, where they'll, once they get in the field, they're going to learn about SART training, and they're going to learn the different agencies and folks that get involved in our casework. So that gets enhanced during field training.
Are you aware of the Victims' Rights Constitutional Amendment, and it's been in previous administrations and through previous commissioners, there's been a elevated level of awareness that sometimes we even have to remind an attorney general about it. But this is a very serious issue with me, that anybody that's going to be involved in interfacing with the public, and that victims' rights be part of that component. And I suspect, judging from Ms. Howell's nodding, there's going to be a more refined answer the next time we're together. Thank you. Representative Austin, and then Guerra.
Yeah, Captain, the training you're talking about taking place in Sitka for VPSO versus troopers, I know that there's been a shortage of VPSO officers, either through not being able to find people or people just quitting on. If you have a new VPSO comes along and goes to Sitka for training, will you automatically give him the firearms training in case the community wants to have a VPSO with firearm?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, yes, it's our intentions. We've talked about that the other day. It's our intentions to try to bring on future applicants that if this bill gets passed, that would be able to qualify for the firearm component. So that would more than likely mean that the process of doing a psychological evaluation would be introduced into the background investigation process in the future. We'll have to wait and see what happens to the bill, but eventually I think that would be the logical thing to do, so we don't have this two-tiered VPSO in the future. Eventually, hopefully, it would morph into a armed unit at some point in history.
Thank you.
Some Guerra.
Thank you, Colonel. I'm just now you're at the point that
he's
still
a captain. He didn't.
Oh, well, Captain. Sorry about that.
I will take a field promotion if you so desire.
Yeah, sorry about the quick promotion and demotion. You had mentioned that there was less scenario-based training, 80 hours versus 280 hours for a VPSO compared to a trooper, if I understood that testimony correct. 280 versus 208, I guess I misheard that. And then you had also mentioned that the crimes are slightly different in areas that VPSOs cover than troopers cover, and which I guess I don't understand that. Are they getting full training in terms of like how to respond to homicides, assaults, rapes, sexual assaults, basic assaults? Are they getting full training on those things? Because those things happen in urban and rural areas. And then what are the things they're not getting training in?
Through the chair, I guess the training, we're not going to train, the crimes aren't different, I guess, in rural versus urban. It's just that we're going to have less emphasis put on crimes that they traditionally wouldn't see in rural Alaska. The crimes that they traditionally would see is the ones we're going to train on, the domestic violence calls, the assault calls, and those more complex crimes aren't ones that they're necessarily going to investigate. They might hold a scene safe and secure until we get there, but we're not spending that time with them at the academy to go through all the elements that would need to be gone through in order to do a full investigation in something of a complex crime.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I have no doubt, though, I just don't know well enough, that maybe there is a difference in the kinds of crimes that are committed. But when I look at 80 hours versus 208 hours for a trooper, is there really that many more kinds of crimes that are committed in urban areas? I mean, what is this big disparity of the kinds of crimes that aren't committed in rural areas that the training isn't coming for?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, it's probably associated with more of the firearm component. Right now, it's the numbers that I have were 88 hours versus 280. I would like to think that additional hours of scenario-based are going to be that firearms and probably the EVOC, what we call emergency vehicle operations training. Two large components at the academy, which would constitute scenario-based training.
And Mr.
Edgman.
Chairman, if I can intervene here, the requirements at this point, if there's a felony situation in a village, are for the VPSO to secure and protect the scene, but to immediately be in contact with his or her oversight trooper.
We're not asking our medics to do complicated surgery.
No.
Okay. Onward, Captain.
And then finally, the last question I heard was the workforce improvement with firearms versus not, and I think Representative Edgman said, you know, I guess the proof will be in the pudding, but I would like to think with the time that I have spent in recruitment, both on military installations, when people are being discharged from the military, to the various, inquiries about the program from Lower 48 police officers and police officers within Alaska. Once they hear the comment that a firearm isn't part of the equation in doing the law enforcement component, we do lose a lot of folks that were in law enforcement prior that carry a firearm. They said, well, I won't do the job without a firearm. And same with the military. They hear stories about rural Alaska and that it's the Wild West, but the VPSO program has a long history of being successful without the firearm, over 40 years. So I think, I would like to think that the firearm will bring in a different caliber of applicant, and I think the issue of longevity, I'm hoping, would stabilize, and would kind of be a better method in which to hold these positions that we have been hiring over the last decade or so. We're losing them as quick as we hire them. Hopefully we would alleviate that.
Representative Gareth.
Thank you. Question from the person with the most densely urban district, maybe. Captain, are we going to provide the same training to VPSOs for things like, talking potentially violent criminals out of a house? Let's say they have a hostage situation, or let's say there's a potential suicidal situation. My understanding is part of the trooper training involves talking people through situations short of force to the extent that's possible, number one. And number two, then under what circumstances it's proper to use force, is that training going to be the same?
Through the chair, yes, sir. It will be the same training. And a lot of times the VPSOs, after they graduate the current academy, we provide other training to enhance their skills. An example would be a course called Verbal Judo, where you're using your mind and language to convince people or de-escalate situations. Those are always wonderful tools, and we expose VPSOs to those kind of training as well. So we would certainly not provide any kind of courses that we think would be valuable to a trooper. We would provide those same courses to a VPSO, both in the academy and then after the academy.
Just finally, Mr. Chair, on this.
Mr. Gareth.
And then I guess this is more of an ask, because I don't know if it's happening, or maybe it is. Tell me. Prosecutors, and I would assume it's even more difficult with remote victims, just often with all of their workload don't have time to spend much time with the victim to tell them about the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, which has funding to help compensate people as much as money can do for crime-related damage. And is that something that VPSOs will be trained in, so that since they're the person on the ground in the village, that they'll be able to advise the victim of those rights? That shouldn't be hard.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, they already get that training. They're mandatory reporters. VPSOs already receive training in that area. On domestic violence cases, they're required to provide that. And any other assault cases, they're required to provide that information, and they're instructed to do so already.
All right, thanks.
There's a prepared pamphlet that the Office of Victims' Rights has available to all departments, and I don't think it should be very hard to make sure that's continued. It just takes an awareness, and it's in our Constitution. 84% of Alaskans supported it. Much a mandate as anything is. But no other questions, Captain Arlo. Were you through with your presentation?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Well, we were just out in the Mat-Su Borough yesterday. What we'd want to know is, will this enable any municipal officials to be able to do traffic stops and carry guns? That's okay. You don't have to answer that one. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, were you asking? Would VPSOs?
No, I'm not asking I'm not asking anything.
I thought I heard you right then.
Yeah.
You demoted him to senator. He's already been demoted twice now.
Any other questions for Captain Arlo? And I hope you'll be around when we have the final hearing on this. I'd like to go to the next person. Thank you very much for your thorough presentation and all the allowing the interruptions to keep to allow us to keep pace and ask questions. Thank you, sir. Next from Anchorage, we have Joe Black. And the last testifier was a prepared expert witness supporting the bill. These others will be testimony by individuals. Mr. Black, are you there?
Mr. Terman, I think there may have been an error. Joe Masters, is that?
Okay. Maybe they're thinking Jack Black and Joe Masters together. And it says, well, I welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Joe Masters, M-A-S-T-E-R-S, and I'm representing myself. Most members of the committee recognize that.
Commissioner, you need to get a little closer to the microphone and give your colonel's voice.
Okay. All right. Is this a little bit better?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, representing myself and from Anchorage. The sponsor of the bill, Representative Edgeman, did a fantastic job on laying out the need and also some of the background of and history of rising assaults and the rates of assaults against police officers in the state, not only for urban officers but for village officers as well, including VPOs and VPSOs. And this bill, I think the sponsor as well as co-sponsors have laid out a very simple change that would encourage or would actually require the Department of Public Safety to move forward with appropriate regulations to assure that VPSOs, if the communities and their employers want them armed, have the ability to be armed. I don't think the bill in any way diminishes any statutory or regulatory authority that the commissioner has already in place. It clarifies that authority for him to or her to be able to establish what that minimum training and certification level will be. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, many years ago started my career as a VPSO, so I have a firm understanding and a solid understanding of what a VPSO's job is and what the responsibilities are and what the unique challenges VPSOs have in trying to carry out those responsibilities. And I've also been in a unique position, along with only other one commissioner, to be sitting as commissioner when the VPSO has been killed in the line of duty due to a felony assault using a firearm. And I have a firm belief that in some cases VPSOs are assaulted and the proper tool needs to be available to them to defend themselves and to defend the communities that they're serving. And it's time that VPSOs are allowed to be carrying firearms again. And I say again because this is not a new concept. VPSOs were allowed to carry firearms at one time very early on in the program. VPSOs and communities that took out additional liability insurance were allowed to be armed. And that practice ended in the mid-80s. And it's my understanding that the reason for that was that their employers were very concerned about the liability aspect. Most of those employers today have changed their thinking, and they're willing to take on that additional liability and responsibility to assure that their employees, the VPSOs that we want in these communities, have the ability to get the training that they would need, have the appropriate oversight, and be able to carry the tools that they need as well. Mr. Chairman, I, at one point in my career, was a trainer at the academy in Sitka, and part of my duties was to conduct firearms training. And there was, in the early 1990s, mid-1990s, there was a program that we called the VPSO-MPA transition, and MPA stands for Municipal Police Academy. And what that was a select number of VPSOs were brought on and came down to the academy to get additional training that met Police Standards Council certification levels. And some of that training included firearms training. So I had the ability at that point to be able to train VPSOs in firearms, specifically handguns, semi-automatic handguns. And my experience has been that there is no more difficulty in training VPSOs in the use of firearms than any other municipal police officer or state trooper. I'm solidly behind their ability to be able to meet that threshold.
I wholeheartedly agree with the critics as well as those that are that would be administering this, that you certainly have to have standards, and those standards should be at the level that any other police officer would be required to meet. So those, and that's what the Department of Public Safety currently is proposing would be the level that, that they bring forward. Mr. Chairman, I, given the amount of time that your committee has already been hearing this bill and probably the number of people that still have to testify, I'd just close my comments with two thoughts. First is that some would give you the notion that you have to train a VPSO to the level of a state trooper in order for them to be able to carry a firearm, and I disagree with that wholeheartedly. You train VPSOs to do their jobs, and their jobs don't necessarily entail all the same things a state trooper would perform. So they don't need that level of training. What they need, though, is they need to have adequate and specific training for the task of carrying a firearm so they can do it safely. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to train a VPSO to the same level as a trooper. And to kind of illustrate that point, we allow today security officers around the state to carry firearms, and they certainly don't go to the police academy for that 18 weeks. The second is that there's wide support for this bill, and the reason there's wide support for this bill is because it's the right thing to do. And I urge the committee, as you hear this bill, get certainly the questions answered in the debate happening, but in the end, I urge you to pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. It was a real pleasure to serve with you as we worked on a lot of these initiatives. Hope you're enjoying your elevation to private citizen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am watching this very closely.
When you were commissioner, did you? I didn't watch all the hearings, but did you have an official position on behalf of the department for which you used to work?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my official position as the head of the Department of Public Safety and therefore the department's position at the time was that we supported this bill.
So since you've become, since your promotion, have you modulated or amplified your support for this? Or,
Mr. Chairman, certainly, you know, as commissioner, I carry forward certainly the necessary actions that the department needs to take to protect the citizens, but I also carried forward what the general policy direction of the governor was certainly at the time because he's the one that was my boss. Certainly, as I change status, I guess, from that position to my current role as citizen, I don't have restrictions on what I can say or not say about the bill, although I don't know necessarily in this case I had a lot of restrictions prior to leaving this position.
So you've probably got out of neutral into more drive or an overdrive on this one?
Mr. Chairman, as I was the commissioner, one of my last hearings was a hearing in Anchorage regarding VPSOs being armed, not specific on this bill, but on the issue in general, and I felt a very strong proponent and driver during that hearing, still in my position.
And
certainly as commissioner was start the process of a regulations change as well, which is currently still underway.
And commissioner, I was only probing because I know in your past position you didn't always. You didn't get to speak for your unrestrained personal opinion, and I value because of your work from VPSO up. So I appreciate your testimony as a private citizen and taking time out today to do that. So thank you, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, and Commissioner, I appreciated your service as well. I thought you brought a lot of honor to the job. So this is either for you or for the sponsor. I'm not sure. I'm a little bit behind both of you. I've always heard that VPSOs have a certain limited authority, and so I've heard secure the premises and protect the victim, certainly important things. But does that mean that VPSOs are not trained in preserving evidence, or where is the line that when I've heard a few times preserving or protecting and securing the premises, I assume that means protecting the victim. But what then is missing that a trooper or police officer is allowed to do that a VPSO isn't beyond that? Is it evidence retention? Is it something along those lines?
I think the sponsor wants you to answer this, Commissioner.
Okay. Through the chair.
Or the captain can, I guess.
Captain Arlo outlined this a little bit in his testimony. The big difference is the difference between immediately responding to an incident that occurs in the community and then continuing that initial response into a prolonged investigative process or procedure. And that's the big difference, particularly in more complex events or in felony crimes, where VPSO certainly will most likely be the immediate first responder in most cases, in most crimes, whether they're felonies or misdemeanors. And they're appropriately trained in that regard. So they do know how to initially respond to crime scenes, protect evidence, collect evidence if they need, identify witnesses so that way investigators later can interview them, do the legally required things such as provide notification for Victims' Rights Act notifications and for other similar types of required notifications of that nature. And what the big difference in their training is with certified police officers and troopers is they don't necessarily get all of the training that's required to complete the investigative processes required for these crimes. And they're not given that training simply because they're not expected or required to do those types of tasks where police officers are. So that's the bulk of really what the difference in their training really accounts for. But VPSOs currently get training on when it's appropriate and what levels are appropriate for using force against individuals that are either a danger to them or others. Coincidentally, they do receive training today on when it's appropriate and not appropriate to use deadly force. Although they don't necessarily have a firearm as a tool, they may be put in a position currently today where they are required to use deadly force, but the tool may be something different. It may be an object that they have available to them. It could be a vehicle, whatever. If they're in a position where they have to defend themselves, they have to know whether they can or can't use that level of force, and that's whether they have a firearm or not. I know there's a lot of talk about that part of the training, which they already get. I think it needs to be enhanced with firearm simulation training and simulator training, which would happen at the academy, and more scenario-based training to go along with it.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Next, we'll go to James Holscher in Hooper Bay. You're listed as a VPSO. Please indicate whether you're speaking for the department or your contract entity or yourself.
I'm testifying on behalf of myself.
You need to get closer to the microphone, Mr. Holscher.
Okay, I'm testifying on behalf of myself.
Go ahead and identify yourself, and please share your testimony with the committee. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and listening. My name is James Holscher. I'm a VPSO First Sergeant stationed in Hooper Bay. I started my law enforcement career here in Hooper Bay in 1994 as a village police officer. I've since then acquired my advanced police officer, certified police officer certificate through APSC. In 2009, I applied to be a VPSO, and I was hired on as a VPSO and stationed here in Hooper Bay. So my entire career has been here in Hooper Bay, serving the people of Hooper Bay. So I guess the reason why I'm calling in is just to share a little bit of my points of view from seeing both sides. From a certified police officer, from a VPO, from a VPSO, and maybe give you a little bit of an idea as to what some of the mindset of what I've gone through, what people I've trained have gone through. something that maybe my families have experienced over the past years of my service as a public servant, whether it be a police officer, village police officer, or village public safety officer. I'm currently a field training officer, first sergeant with the VPSO program, and some of the questions that you guys brought up, maybe I can not to say that Captain Arlo or former Commissioner Masters didn't answer them well, but maybe I can give you some of the things that I've heard and some of the things that I've learned over the years. First off, you know, one of you brought up about families, about some of the things Representative Edgman brought up, talking about when a VPSO's wife was worried about them going on calls. I can say without a doubt that that is one of the things that, you know, until you look at the worried face of a spouse and children, it's very difficult to explain. Whether we have, when I had a firearm, when I was a certified police officer as a chief of police for the Hooper Bay Police Department, or as recently as yesterday when I got called out to assist and arrest a couple people, one for a felony assault and one for another assault, the difference on their look is, the look on their face is the same. There's really no difference. But I think when I had a firearm and I had that tool available to me, there was a little bit less of a worry for my wife, because she knew that if for some reason that something bad were to happen, I would have that tool available to me. Now when I look at her, all she can do is pray. And, you know, when I come home and after I'm done with the call, I come home and she's laying in bed, and I see that she's awake, and she obviously has been crying because she's been worried about me. It really makes me question whether if I'm doing what I'm doing is right or not. Because to put my family through that much duress and, you know, repeated stress, it's very difficult to do. But I feel because I have a calling and because, you know, it's what I have done over the past 20 years, my entire adult life, it's something that I really fall back on, and I have to do my best to, I guess, serve my community. So I guess in that respect, that's what I can share from my point of view, my family's point of view. As for retention for VPSOs, after training several VPSOs, village police officers over the years, one of the things that I've heard, and, you know, people that say they wouldn't apply for this job because we don't carry firearms, they said if we started carrying firearms, maybe they would start applying. And then, like Captain Arlo said, you open up the doors for a different level or a different caliber of applicants. You get more applicants, more people in the applicant pool. You get more professional, the chance of more professionals serving your communities. Not to say that the current VPSOs aren't professional. I believe that the VPSOs that I work with are some of the best people that I could ever have imagined working with. But you also get to where people have applied to be a VPSO, and the moment that they get called to respond to a domestic violence that's active or an active misconduct involving weapons call, they quit soon after that, and they say, this isn't for me, it's too dangerous. So it is my belief, and again, the proof will be in the pudding if this will help with retention, but it is my belief that it will. I believe that you will have retention and longevity because of this. Unfortunately, I work in one of the communities where law enforcement is one of the primary duties of a VPSO because it is what's asked of me. I believe that probably about 95% of what I do is law enforcement. I'm sorry, I took some notes. I'm trying to find my place. With a high percentage of duties, with VPSOs that serve in areas where there is a high percentage of duties, you see there is a higher turnover rate in those places because they're more exposed to danger. In Hooper Bay alone, I know Hooper Bay over the past 20 years has seen at least 7 VPSOs come and go. Hooper Bay has been a pretty high law enforcement percentage area where a lot is requested of us as VPSOs to respond to active calls for service involving domestic violences, gun calls, DUIs, those sort of things. Now, I'm sorry?
No, that was a cough. You're fine.
Okay. Now, as for training, I know that from my training as a municipal police officer and seeing the training and attending trainings as VPSOs, the training is at the core of things the same. There is more extensive training that I received as a municipal officer, and most of it has been scenario-based training. And I believe that, you know, if this bill were to pass and the people that were carrying firearms were to go through, I believe that you would see an increase in scenario-based training for VPSOs, knowing that they have that added responsibility of carrying a gun. Now, we talk about the use of force, the training and the use of force. We all receive training in use of force, and like former Commissioner Masters had stated, is we do get trained in when to use deadly force, when not to, even though we're not carrying a firearm. We do have certain tools available to us that, you know, as he stated, a vehicle or something else that might be close by available to us, we have to know when we're able to use that. And the thing is a lot of times they talk about when not to use firearms and when to use firearms. I think VPSOs are very good at what they do in the sense of not using firearms because we already know that we're going to a call where we're not able to use firearms. So that tool isn't available to us right now. So I think over the years we have garnered not only the knowledge that most of us need to respond and use verbal judo or use you know, certain other tools to defuse a situation, especially talking with people and, you know, being trusted in the community. I think that has something major to do with it, because right now we are unarmed, and I think the aspect of us carrying a firearm or having another tool available to us would only serve as, for the most part, a deterrent. And that would be my number one hope, is to have something that is there if we need it, but also to let people be aware that if we do have it, it may deter larger crimes from happening. So, in closing, I just want to thank Representative Edgman for sponsoring this bill. And I wanted to make myself available for any questions if you guys possibly have for any VPSOs. I've been listening closely over the past couple months to this, and I've noticed that one of the components that has been missing is testimony from a VPSO. And if you guys have any questions, I would like to make myself available to answer them as best as I can.
I don't see any. Thank you, Officer Holscher. Appreciate your testimony. And glad we have a officer on record testifying for himself and probably reflecting some of the views of other officers, I would suspect. Is there anybody else online? Is there anybody else here in Juneau that wishes to testify? We'll go ahead and close public testimony. We'll always leave the option for opening it up if there is. But our major issue here is going to be dealing with the fiscal issues, but I think it's been very instructive for over a quarter of the legislature to get a chance to hear this bill and the issues. I appreciate when bills come to finance just because a fourth of us get to hear a bill, which we don't necessarily do if it goes to, say, just state affairs or labor and commerce or pick the committee. So I appreciate that this did pick up the accurate fiscal note. I think it's there is some caution. We don't really know what the fiscal impact is. I think it's been the best guess, and we need to probe that a little more. But it is a public policy initiative that nothing we do here is free. So
We're going to set the bill aside and come back and have a much more lengthy discussion on the fiscal note issues. So any closing before we leave?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. First off, I want to thank you for the latitude that you've given this discussion today. I think it's been a real good, wide-ranging discussion, including testimony from an actual BPSO or the municipal officer himself. Just a couple of quick comments, if I might. Over the 40-year history of the program, there have been two fatalities, and I'd like for the record to reflect, certainly I think the one that we all know about last March 19th, Officer Madol losing his life, but as well in 1986, October 22nd, Ronald Zimmon in the village of South Naknek was shot in the line of duty and killed as well. Both those fatalities, of course, in Bristol Bay. The second point would be to give kudos to the governor, certainly former Commissioner Master, for their devotion to the program, for their commitment to increasing the actual number of VPSOs that are out there in the communities, a number which has basically doubled in the last handful of years. So I really appreciate that commitment to the program itself.
Thank you. We'll set this aside, and our next foray in this will be talking about the fiscal issues. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just a closing comment. I just had to go down the hall and back and walk past an armed security guard right here in the Capitol who is probably nowhere near the training that these VPSOs go through. And those are the people that are walking around the Capitol with a gun. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, we'll set this bill aside. We're going to take it just about a two-minute at ease, a real two-minute at ease, until we prepare for the next bill.
Thanks again, Mr. Chairman.
Stand briefly at ease. Finance, come back to order. It's 3:17 after a two-plus-minute brief at ease. We have our last bill today is House Bill number 32. Representative Newman, can you move the CS, and I'll have committee staff explain the changes.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I would like to move committee substitute for House Bill number 32, version /Y, for committee discussion.
I'll object for the presentation, and please introduce yourself, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Daniel George. I serve as staff representative Stoltz on the Finance Committee. Before members is CS for House Bill number 32, Finance, version /R.
Does everybody have that?
Mm-hmm. Motion was for /Y.
Yeah.
Why?
This is dated 2/2014. Would you like to restate the motion, Representative Newman, Mr. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move for committee consideration, committee substitute for House Bill number 32, version /R, dated 2/2014.
Objection maintained. Mr. George.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, version R, the CS for House Bill 32, incorporates the exchange of the words trades, services, professions, or activities in their singular or plural forms throughout the bill in seven locations, including within the title. It exchanges trade, services, professions, and activities for the words lines of business or line of business. This occurs in page 1, line 1, page 1, line 8, page 1, line 12, page 2, line 3 and 4, page 2, line 21 and 25. Additionally, the CS includes the addition of section 4, page 2, lines 14 through 17, which add the statutory definition of lines of business within the definitions of the Business Licensing Act.
And these were these weren't changes we dreamed up. These were in consort with the sponsor and the department. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. At the previous hearing of this bill, the committee brought forward questions regarding the definition in statute of lines of business, since the bill deals with that term specifically. And this language was intended to deal specifically with that concern.
And it's your intent, Representative Costello, to clear up some of the confusion and clarify through this language?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. This was in direct response to Representative Osterman's question, and this is our solution to that.
Representative Guttenberg on the CS.
Thank you. On the lines of trade, is thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there another? Is it used anywhere else in statute? Is this unique and a new definition?
Mr. George, and you can call up the department if you need to.
Mr. Chairman, the words trade, services, professions, and activities are actually utilized within the definition in AS 4371.10.1, which is business, where it talks about it uses those phrases within the definition. It's not within the bill itself, okay. So I apologize. They are not defined, but they are used within the definition of business. So this is in order to clarify what a line of business would be. And I can make available to members a copy of that statute if the chair wishes.
Are there any other questions, Representative Guttenberg?
So I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, we're on interesting ground. So what this does is it, by going from trades and services, it allows the department to to better define them as far as one licensing practice?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Guttenberg. By going from trades. From the more ambiguous lines of business in the previous version. Mr. George.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I would defer to the sponsor for the intention, as this language was developed in collaboration with her office as well as the Finance Committee and the department, and perhaps the department can talk to the implications of using this definition.
So, Costello, your call.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, I'd like to sit at the table and then invite my staff up because he's been working on the bill.
Very good.
Thank you.
Bring your lifeline.
Mr. Gitchard. Representative Costello. Better to flesh this out here than in, on the floor. I appreciate the question, Representative Gutenberg.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'm Representative Mia Costello. I represent District 20, and with me this afternoon is my legislative aide, Charles Ginchard.
Mr. Chairman, Charles Ginchard, staff to Representative Costello for the record. Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, Mr. George was correct in that that terminology for the amendment was pulled directly from existing statute in the definition of business. It's my understanding that the department interprets that as a direct correlation to the federal mix codes, that being when you look at a particular business's business license, you will see a mix code has been determined, and the corresponding short title of that code will be on the business license.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so my concern is, is that we took a use someplace else, and we've put it in here, and the meeting now has two different versions. Can you assure me that that's not the case, that the meaning means the same thing in both places?
The intent of the
I don't know if you can assure him, but you can explain it
yes.
more fully.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, the intent of the change was to have the definition of business in statute work together with the definition of line of business.
Okay.
If you were to read it, have this bill passing, it would be that a business is defined as an entity that may accomplish various different things, and the definition of line of business would be any one particular thing that that business then does.
Okay. Are there any other questions on this proposed CS? I'll withdraw my objection. Is there any objection maintained to adopting CS as previously moved by the Vice Chair? Hearing none, it's before us. I think we've already discussed it. For were there any other questions on the CS as has now been adopted? And Representative Costello, I think the other issue we'd probably have is the fiscal note. We discussed that previously. You're usually right to my left here. From that juxtaposition, it's fairly straightforward. Potential loss, it's a best guesstimate of the fiscal note. You have it before you? Or?
Through the
I just want it on the
Mr.
record.
Mr. Co-Chair, we have provided all of the committee members a list of the over 700-some businesses that would actually be affected by this legislation, and we feel comfortable with the fiscal note with a $8,500 needed in order to carry out the administrative work, essentially, and a change in revenue of a loss to the state of $37,500, which, as the sponsor of this legislation, I feel is better in the hands of small business owners than the government.
Thank you, Matt. And that's my position, too. We've had that discussion of whose hip pocket some fees will rest in, whether it's municipalities or our constituents, but we don't win them all. But I suspect, I'll just editorialize, I think the opportunity this might cause some more people to be hired and more commerce to be conducted is a likely event, a likely consequence. So I like this bill. Are there any questions on the bill? Any amendments? You know, amendments.
Representative Newman, would you like to do the honors?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 32, Finance, version backslash R, dated 2/2014, from committee with any individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Are there any objections? Hearing none, the bill's passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And even with a late start, we're out of here before 3:30. Co-chair, did you have anything else?
No.
Other than to invite people to be here at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. We have Senate Bill 49 and the companion bill, House Bill 173, up tomorrow morning, and we will deal with that measure in the morning. And we'll see where that takes us. So hearing no other business, we will stand adjourned and look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow morning.